come on in.
And now, back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
The kids love him.
And your host,
welcome to paradise,
Bill Frank.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Bill Frank. My show examines how others see the world so you can better understand your world. Economists view the world differently than you and I, and their perspective often challenges our beliefs. Some know economics as the dismal science. My next guest is anything but dismal, however. He's co-written a series of books that makes economics fun. We'll tackle some of life's perplexing problems from an economist's point of view and hopefully provoke some of your thinking. Stephen Dubner is an award-winning author, journalist, radio, and TV personality. He quit his first career as an almost rock star to become a writer. He's worked for the New York Times, and he's published 3 non-freakonomics books. He lives in New York City with his family. Joining us from New York, hi, Stephen. How are you today?
Hi, Bill. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. And I want to start kind of at 30,000 feet with you, if I can, please, and ask you the question, what do most people get wrong about economics?
I think most people actually get a lot right about economics, which is that they think of when you say economics to most people, what they picture is a kind of old-fashioned, very mathematical way of describing what we think of as the economy, the macroeconomy, because most of the prominent economists that they see are those old-fashioned mathematical, theoretical guys who get on TV and talk to you about, you know, macroeconomic growth and so on. And as it turns out, those guys are mostly wrong. It turns out that economists of that sort are not very helpful in really describing, you know, how the economy works, even in the past, but especially at predicting the future. I mean, you see that most economists are totally absent when it comes to describing what's going to happen in the economy. And that's because it's a hard thing to do. The world is pretty complex. What we try to do, and the kind of economists that I work with, including my co-author, Steve Levitt, they're much less ambitious. Rather than trying to say, you know, I can tell you how the world economy is going to evolve over the next 2 years, which is impossible, they'll say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to try to find a data set that reflects some kind of behavior, whether it's the way people buy their homes, the way people educate their children, the way people name their children, the way sports happen, the way people bet on sports and so on. If I can find some data and analyze it and ask some good questions of those data, then I can maybe answer some questions that, while not as ambitious as those big economic questions, at least I have a better chance of being right and describing the world the way it actually works rather than guessing, and trying to understand a little bit better the way that people actually make decisions. So that's what we try to do with all our Freakonomics books, is just examine these different areas that are interesting to us and fun for us, and try to better understand the way people behave and what kind of incentives they respond to and so on.
Well, I think that that's great, and I think you hit the nail on the head from the economist's point of view. But from the general public's point of view, I want to float this one by you if I can, please, because most of us, when we think about economics, we think about the risks of the future and so forth. We kind of overstate the risks of big, dramatic, cataclysmic events, and we certainly underestimate the risks of ordinary, common events. What were your thoughts on that?
Absolutely true. So, you just articulated it better than I ever could, frankly. I'll give you 2 examples, one on each extreme. Terrorism, right?
Right.
A terrorist attack is a horrible, tragic, frightening event with huge costs, but it's also very rare, okay? If you look at the amount of terror that the average citizen in the U.S. is susceptible to encounter, you'll see it's close to zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Obviously it does, and it's, again, horrible and tragic when it happens, plus which it's hard for us to enumerate the terrorist attacks that haven't happened, that have been prevented by good law enforcement and national intelligence and so on. So that's hard to say. But without question, we fear terrorism a great, great, great deal, especially in comparison to how relatively rare it is. Then you look at the other end of the extreme, something that we probably should think about more but don't. It's remarkable how little we know scientifically about nutrition, right? So
right.
As a species, we've been eating for a long time. If you look at what we actually know about what's good for the human body, we don't know that much. In fact, just 30 years ago, the USDA and the federal government was putting out dietary guidelines that now the best scientists in the world laugh at. They say, wait a minute, you were saying that all fat was terrible and that we should be eating, you know, many, many more servings of carbohydrates, which turn into sugar, which can give an entire population diabetes? That's nuts. That's how little we know and have known about nutrition. And yet we don't, every day we all eat and drink without really thinking so much about the inputs. Another example like that is sleep. We have very primordial understanding of how important sleep is to all our, you know, health outcomes and income outcomes and education and so on. So there are these things that we take for granted that we think we don't have to think about so much, eating and sleeping, which are actually much more important to the average person than the fear of terrorism. And yet, because of the way our society works, our media works, and the fact that the human brain is very susceptible to getting scared, we pay a lot more attention to big, scary anomalies rather than small daily events that are actually much more influential.
That is true. My guest is Stephen Dubner, co-author of the book When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. And Stephen, I want to drill down on a couple of those examples that you gave because they're brilliant. And I'm going to start with the first one that you started with, which was terrorism. TSA has been in the news a lot lately for, well, let's face it, having failed some tests of catching the security people going through to test their abilities to catch terrorists. And you in the book actually call this security, what do you call it? You call this security theater.
It's called security theater sometimes.
Right. And, yeah. And security theater is interesting, but the point that you make in the book is rather interesting about how much we're spending on TSA vis-a-vis what it actually might be preventing or what it might be solving. Would you drill into this just a little bit more about the differential between appearing to fight terrorism and actually fighting terrorism?
Yeah, you know, this is a tricky one because the way that incentives work and the way that security works in particular, it's all, you know, if I'm running the TSA, or if I'm running a federal or state agency that's concerned with patrolling and policing against possible terrorist activities, it's very hard to kind of put a number on my value because for every, you know, the public doesn't see all the prevention that might be happening. And if I'm a potential terrorist and I look at, you know, at TSA staffing every single airport in the country, I've got to think, you know, I'm going to look elsewhere. So the fact is then as a rational thinker, you'd say, okay, well, let's look elsewhere. Maybe if the TSA is doing a great job and if every dollar we spend is worth it, they're protecting the airlines, but then the crime, the terrorism is going elsewhere. Because criminals, whether they're terrorists or whatever, they're as rational as the rest of us. We might think of criminals as dumb or immoral or whatever, but criminals respond to incentives just like other people do. And so if you say, well, let's look at all the other terrorism that's happening now in the U.S., not on airlines, you say, well, wow, there isn't that much. So one conclusion that you can draw from that is, as frightening and tragic as terrorism is, there's relatively a tiny amount of it. And therefore, that should really modulate the way that you think about it. Look, for everything we do in life, there is a trade-off, and that's what economics really is about. It's the trade-off between the benefit and the cost. So let's take something smaller than terrorism. Let's take drunk driving, for instance.
All right. Bill.
And if I say, you know, look, here's the data on drunk driving. Still, I think somewhere around about 40% of all traffic fatalities in the U.S. are involved drunk driving. Drunk driving is a tragedy that has cost trillions of dollars, many, many, many lives. It's ridiculous, really. And we might say, you know, we should have it. Let's get it down to zero. So if I say my goal today is to get drunk driving down to zero, I can do it. Here's how I would do it. I would set up a police roadblock at every mile on every road in America. And whenever I caught someone driving drunk, we'd pull them out of the car and we would execute them on the spot.
Wow.
I promise you that would end drunk driving, right? But we look at that and say, well, that's barbaric, it's expensive, we don't want to do that. But that would be the cost to gain the benefit. So we know that what we want in society is to have that trade-off be somewhere where we can live with the cost while living with the benefit. And I think that when it comes to terrorism right now in this country, I'm guessing, it's really just an educated guess, that we're spending a lot more than the benefit we're gaining.
I would have to agree with you. You write in the book, as a matter of fact, that for most government officials, there is more pressure to look like you're trying to stop terrorism than there is actually to stopping terrorism. And I think there's a great deal of truth to that. My guest is Stephen Dubner. Stephen, I want to switch gears on you and talk about something else that you mentioned, which was the whole obesity thing. And in the book, you call it a panic. That's the way you describe it, over obesity. And you say that the panic over obesity may actually be as big as the problem of obesity itself. And an interesting subpoint on all of that was the fact the connection that you made between killing off smoking, stopping people from smoking, and the rise of obesity. So connect the dots for me. What did killing off smoking have to do with the rise in obesity? And why is the panic of obesity actually as big a problem as the overweight obesity itself?
Gotcha. Okay, so it turns out that if you look for all the causes of the rise in obesity, that one of them is the decline in smoking. So as it turns out, that one thing that happens if you're a smoker is you consume fewer calories because of what the cigarettes and the nicotine do for your appetite. Now, so talk about a trade-off, right? So does that mean that for every person who's obese, we want them to take up smoking? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But it's good to know what's actually causing what so that we're not just guessing. Now, when it comes to the rise in obesity and why it's a panic and why a panic is bad, what happens with a panic is that people rush to do something, even if the something is not the right thing. And so rather than understanding what the actual problem is, we just rush off to stick a finger in the dike to address what we think the problem is. So when we began to notice in this country that a lot of people were getting fat, one of the most obvious choices that we made to combat that was to say, we have to get people to stop eating food that contains fat because, well, the adjective wouldn't be called fat if it weren't related to the noun in the food, right?
Right.
Well, as it turns out, science is telling us that's probably wrong. Turns out that a certain amount of fat is not only tolerated in the diet, but really good for the diet. And especially if you replace all that fat with foods that are with carbohydrates and sugars, which are turn out to have all kinds of effect on the body, most of which are really not good. That's a classic case of where we panic about too many people being overweight. We attack the wrong villain, or a villain that's in part wrong, at least fat. And it's not like people are going to go from eating fat to eating zero. They're going to substitute. And in this case, we got people really, really excited about eating this very delicious and often very cheap substitute, which was carbs. So, you know, if you ask the best nutritional scientist you can get a hold of now, what's better to eat? 4 ounces of steak, whether lean or fatty, or a Dunkin' Donut, they're going to opt for the steak. The steak is better. But that's not the message that we've given for a long time. And that's what happens when you panic, is you go to find the first available solution as opposed to one that might actually make sense.
My guest is Stephen Dubner, co-author of the book When to Rob a Bank. And Stephen, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book?
You know, the world is really interesting if we let it be. If you let yourself wander through the world and ask questions and be truly curious and not be afraid to ask the kind of questions that other people might not, and then you try to figure out the answers to them, life not only becomes more fun, but you can be more productive. You can really help people solve problems by not just accepting the conventional wisdom and not just accepting that because this is the way it is, it makes a lot of sense to stay. You know, I get my health insurance through my employer. I guess that makes the most sense. Well, does it really? You know, that's kind of an accident of U.S. history. Most countries don't tie health insurance to your job, and that actually creates a lot of problems. It turns every employer into a secondary healthcare sales force, and it creates job lock. People don't want to change or lose their jobs because that's where their health insurance comes from. So in retrospect, that doesn't seem very smart, but that's what we have. So if you're willing to challenge a conventional wisdom and moreover, be supportive of other people who do it, especially politicians. We pen our politicians into these little cages where if they say something that's even a little bit politically incorrect, we crucify them, and I think that hurts us all.
It definitely does. All right, Stephen, let me turn the tables on you. What did you get out of writing the book?
Well, let's see. One of the most fun things for me in going back over all these posts that we'd written was one topic that especially my co-author had written about a lot over the years, which was golf. And he was obsessed. So my co-author, Steve Levitt, was a really good junior golfer and really thought that he would become a pro one day. And Jack Nicklaus was his idol, and that was his dream. And he was pretty good. And then in this one junior tournament, he got beat by a kid who was a few years younger than him and not very athletic looking. And this kid beat him. And so Levitt, as the result of that, decided, you know what, I'm not going to make it, so I'm going to quit. So he quit. And then that kid turned out to be go on to have an unbelievably great career as a professional golfer. His name is Tim Herron, Tim Lumpy Herron. And so Levitt, long after Freakonomics came out, by now in his late 30s, early 40s, decided, you know, maybe there's still hope for me. Maybe I can get good enough by 50 to make the Champions Tour, the senior tour in golf. So he's become obsessed with trying to get good enough to make the Champions Tour. And now we are collectively obsessed with golf, and we're trying to work on a book about that. And so really it was by going back and reading those obsessive posts about learning golf that I think fueled our next project. So that worked out pretty well.
Well, I hope that your obsession does turn into something good for us. My guest has been Stephen Dubner, co-author of the book When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warp Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. If you've piqued the interest, Stephen, of some of my listeners, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
Freakonomics.com is easy. Amazon.com is easy. We also put out a free weekly podcast called Freakonomics Radio that is available wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's iTunes or if you're an Android user. There's all different kinds of podcast apps and platforms, but we do that. You know, like I said, every week free, more Freakonomics content.
No, that is great, and you're being modest there. It's one of the top 10 podcasts in the country. Stephen, thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
I really appreciate it, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.